Hello and welcome to this week's Big Boat interview. This week I am talking to Ian Howcroft, who is the captain of the legendary 90-metre Lursen Phoenix 2. Phoenix 2 obviously very famous for her prominent figurehead and her amazing Andrew Winch Art Deco interior. Ian talks a bit about the refit that's underway on the yacht currently in Barcelona, the upcoming charter season, and the secrets to keeping great crew. I should also mention that Phoenix 2 is currently for sale with Cecil Wright and Burgess, and she is obviously ready to book your next charter in the Med in 2024. So without further ado, here is my interview with Ian Howcroft. Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us on the Boat Briefing podcast. Can you tell us, first of all, a bit about where you are at the moment?
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm in Barcelona at the moment in MB92 shipyard doing a fairly lengthy refit, about 7 months. So, yeah.
How long have you been on board Phoenix 2 as captain?
Coming up for 3 years now. So, yeah, decent stint. I joined in 2001. So, yeah, it's going well.
And so what work are you undertaking? You said it's a fairly extensive refit. Can you tell us a bit more about what that entails?
So the major job that we had to do was the QL4 on our MTU main engines, which is the biggest rebuild you can do. Basically involves stripping out virtually everything, cylinders, heads, everything. And then you're just left with the engine block and you turn it upside down. And that allows you to access the crankshaft and to measure that and check that it's within tolerance. So it's a massive rebuild of the engine. Just rotating the engine block itself is quite an undertaking. You have to build a special gantry above it and whatever. So that is a big and expensive and lengthy job. As part of that, we then do the gearboxes. So again, full rebuild on that, check everything's within tolerance. And then because all that is disconnected in terms of the shafting, we're doing everything in the shaft line. So checking the shafts are true, the props are away for balancing. Obviously to do that, we have to drop the rudders. So we're doing a full check of all our rudders and rudder sleeves and everything like that. And, while we're at it, doing all the thrusters, so they're all dropped out, checking, overhauling those, stabilizers, all that sort of stuff. So more or less, particularly on the underwater, it's a full rebuild back to wouldn't say new condition, but nearly new condition. And then we're also taking the opportunity to do a fair amount of paintwork. We're painting roughly half the boat, the hull, the forward area, forward jacuzzi, and then the transom. So that's again, when she comes out, she'll look great, shiny, and brand new looking. And then the rest of the stuff, we're doing obviously our Lloyd surveys, intermediate surveys. We're doing a few, upgrades here and there. We're doing all our sort of pre-summer maintenance, which is quite a stringent regime that we have anyway to try and, ensure no breakdowns during the summer. It's a pretty busy time.
And mainly mechanical then, it's fair to say.
That was the main reason why we came, and the paint job itself is another big and an expensive job. So
I was going to, because Phoenix 2 is so well known for her Art Deco interior, and so that is untouched. She'll still be an Art Deco masterpiece when she pops out the other side of your period at MB92.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm not going to be responsible for changing anything to do with the Andrew Winch masterpiece. We just do maintenance and touch ups and making sure everything's in good condition. But we're not changing anything.
And what's it like taking care of an interior, that famous? It is a Winch masterpiece.
Yeah, it's a real privilege and it's a real pleasure. To show people and to have guests on board, enjoying it. It's really good at boat shows, showing people who haven't been on board before. A couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to have Andrew come on board and do a tour, which gave us a lot of insights into, you know, the thinking in the background and the, you know, even elements of the design that we hadn't appreciated. So that was a real privilege, and not, you know, helps my spiel during the tours. A few little nuggets dropped in there. But yeah, you know, it's a stunning interior, and it's really interesting to see how integrated it is throughout the boat, you know, in the cabins, in the lobbies, and in the guest spaces. So, yeah.
Yeah. And the and you were at Monaco a few years ago.
Yeah, we've done it the last 2 years, I guess.
Yeah. What's it like taking a 90-meter boat into the port when it's so busy during show season?
Yeah, well, you know, the docking itself, you know, usually goes okay, but you know, it's a very busy time. You know, the previous time when I did it in 2022, I don't think I got off the boat for more than an hour. You know, it was continuously showing people around. And inevitably, a lot of the people that come on board, especially when you're for sale, you know, if it's a prospective client, then the broker will mention that, you know, it's better if the captain does it. So yeah, it's a very busy time. There's a lot of interest. You know, we always try and obviously keep it down, you know, so it's not free for all. Yeah, boat shows are busy.
Yeah. And also, because she is for sale, obviously. So are you taking any client visits on at the moment, or are you...
We haven't actually had any in the shipyard. You know, if someone was serious and wanted to come, then of course we'll show. It's a bit difficult because let's say when you're painting a boat, you know, access is quite difficult, and it's hard to see the big picture in a tent behind plastic and whatever. But you know, if someone's serious and wants to see what we're doing, then of course we'll show them.
And you've been on Phoenix 2 for a while now, so you mean. You are obviously incredibly familiar with the boat, and you must love it because you've stuck around. So as a boat to operate, and given your experience as a captain, you'd say it was, you know, it's a great boat to run.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off with, you know, being a Lursen. It's super solid, super well-made, well-engineered. I'm really lucky. One of my chief engineers did the build, which is an enormous luxury to have as a captain, to have that resource and that knowledge. You know, to fall back on. And yeah, she's a great boat. I think actually she's kind of like in the Goldilocks size, you know, not too big, not too small, just under 3,000 tons. We can't get in every port, obviously, but we can get in most of where that, you know, our guests want to go. And but she's still big enough to, you know, to be able to, for example, do a 100 people party, you know, without too much drama. You know, to be able to go out into decent sea without, you know, obviously we don't want to go out in terrible seas, but yeah, so she's a lovely boat to run, yeah.
But being 90 meters long, she probably, you know, presumably she could, and a Lursen, she could take pretty much whatever the seas can throw at her.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the case that the ship can, but, you know, you're always worried about the interior. You can, in 10 minutes of a bad decision, you can do a lot of damage to the interior. So, but you know, naturally, the structure of the ship you have a lot of confidence in, yeah.
And what is the kind of typical cruising year of Phoenix 2? Does she have a set pattern?
Yeah, I think historically, you know, before my time and certainly in my time, we've done Med Caribbean, so you know, chartering and some private use in the Mediterranean, and then going across to the Caribbean.
And she's, you know, she costs a bit to charter for a week. She's over €1 million, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right? So what's charter demand been like? Obviously, we had the COVID blip. And then since then, it seemed the charter market exploded. But from what I'm hearing is that next season is looking a bit slower than it has been in previous years.
Yeah. You know, the last two summers, our Mediterranean summers, have been great. We've had a decent number of bookings, 7 or 8 weeks, roughly. So that's been, you know, very rewarding, busy enough. You know, we could have squeezed one more in, but, you know, that was a really good season for both of those years. The Caribbean seasons, to be honest, have been a little bit disappointing. We've gone over with charter bookings with the expectation of picking up more, and we haven't picked up more. So that's been a little bit disappointing. But, you know, we were in the right place at the right time. It was just that the demand wasn't there.
do all captains and owners kind of face that dilemma every year, don't they, whether they send the boat across to the Caribbean? Because there's no guarantee. I mean, if you go across with some charters, it's great, but it's a shorter season anyway. And then if you don't pick up some, it can be, like you said, a fairly disappointing couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, we do a cost benefit. We've always had a booking, usually over the sort of Christmas New Year period. And it's heavily dependent on the fuel price, of course. You know, we were still breaking even with the bookings that we had, but the second winter that I did, so that would be the most recent 22-23, the fuel price was considerably higher.
Yeah.
And so we were a lot closer to our break even point. And then you've got to factor in, you know, it's miles on the hull, it's hours on the engines. And so if you don't pick up those extra ones, it is a bit of a disappointment.
I guess that's what, because you talk to a lot of people from outside the industry and they assume it's just it's a money now object industry, but it's not. Even with a 90 meter boat, you know, the pounds and the pennies are scrutinized, especially when you're making a big decision about sending your boat across the Atlantic.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we've been running more or less as a charter boat for the last 2 years, and we've been approaching pretty close to covering our costs, which of course is a big reassurance. But there's always the trade-off, of course. If owners are willing to give over their yacht for those prime periods, then you can cover your costs, you know, in July and August. If they offer their boat for charter, but it's only, you know, May and September or something like that, then, you won't get anywhere near covering your costs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting calculation every year for people. And there's more and more boats entering the charter market all the time, obviously. So I just hope the next mid-summer season is a strong one for everyone's sake. Mm.
Yeah, me too.
So have you given the crew some time off over this period? Or are you running full ship, or are you skeleton staff while you're in the shed?
Yeah, something in between. We're definitely, you know, on a reduced crew. But, you know, while you're in the shipyard, the more people you have, the more you can achieve. Whether it's, you know, in the engineering department, or my deckhands at the moment are painting the tenders, which is, you know, an enormously valuable thing to do. Would cost a lot if I was to get the shipyard to do it. So, you know, those sort of jobs, the more you can do, the more value you can add. So we're certainly not down at skeleton crew at the moment.
Well, I think it's always great when I hear stories about refits, because the natural assumption is you kind of devolve all responsibility to the refit yard. But when, you know, often it's much more cost effective, like you said, for crew to actually get involved in the work and take on some of the labour.
Yeah, for sure. And it's good for them as well. They learn new skills, you know, something that they can apply either in their further yachting career or shore-based. So, yeah, it's all good.
And has Phoenix 2 got a good record of keeping crew?
Definitely more recently, you know, as we've more focused on the charter, definitely in 2023 we had very good retention, you know, from people that did the previous year with us. You know, this seems to be something about charter that makes people stick around.
I wonder what it is.
Yeah. It must be the hard work.
And I have to ask the question, actually, because we've got in the February issue of the magazine, which has been out recently, we do a big piece about Below Deck, because it's 10 years since that TV show debuted on our screens. As a captain who runs a big crew, what are your thoughts about the TV show? Kind of good, bad, ugly?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it shows an aspect of the industry that, you know, in my opinion, doesn't really exist. It's a TV dramatization or fantasy. You know, a lot of the behavior that takes place wouldn't take place, you know, on a professional yacht, and certainly doesn't happen on mine. So, you know, I think a lot of crew, or some crew, have joined the industry with those false impressions of, you know, jacuzzi parties and what have you. The unfortunate reality is that it's not quite so exciting. There's a lot more hard work and a lot less drama. So that's kind of the negatives. And I assume, you know, it's I guess at the 90 meter level, it doesn't really run true. But I assume some guests also coming to charter smaller yachts might have an impression that that's what happens on yachts. And I think that's a bad impression for, you know, for prospective yacht owners to think that the crew are behaving like that, or that, you know, it's acceptable for some of the guests to behave how they do on the show. So that's kind of the negatives, I'd say. That on the positive side, you know, we do need to bring new entrants into this industry on the crewing side. You know, there's an enormous projected shortfall of crew to run all these new yachts that are being launched. And I believe that Below Deck is a recruiter for the industry.
Yeah.
You know, as I've said, some of them might end up having slightly skewed perceptions of what's expected, and et cetera. But, you know, there's millions and millions of young people who are watching that program and thinking, oh, maybe yachting is for me. And you know, maybe I'll have a look. So pluses and minuses.
Yeah, I think that's most people's calculation, really. Yeah, the behavior is extraordinary. But it has, yeah, like you said, it's opened a lot of people's eyes to something they didn't know existed before. But I was talking to the captain of another very large yacht the other day, and he made the same point. What some of the crew who have been exposed to the industry and coming into a big boat now, in expectations of it being kind of a bit of a party, are often in for a very rude awakening as they discover their job principally is cleaning and endless polishing, and you know, it's not jumping into the jacuzzi after a few beers.
Yeah, unfortunately not. Not anymore anyway. Maybe in the 90s, but yeah, not anymore.
but it's fascinating to me how this industry is exposed to people. But new entrants are key, owners, charterers, crew as well. I mean, your advice to kind of young crew listening to this, who are thinking about getting into the yachting industry, what would that be?
Get on a decent sized yacht, you know, as your first yacht, you know, try and get on a decent sized 60 meter plus, and just spend the first year learning and seeing if it's really for you. If you think it's for you, then start to invest the time and the money in you know, the training courses and moving up the ladder. But, you know, I think it's always disappointing when people spend a fortune on the training and then get their first job and find out that they, you know, they get seasick, or that it's not for them. They can't do the confinement or the, you know, the close living quarters or whatever. So yeah, I think it's important to dip your toe in and see if it's for you, and if you want to make it a, you know, a career for the next, you know, medium term, you know, five 7 years, something like that. And if so, get trained up. You know, do your courses, whether you're working in the interior or the exterior or the engine room.
And a lot of owners I speak to are challenged by crew longevity. They kind of throw their arms in the air and they think. Crew are quite flighty. Do you think they're more flighty nowadays? They're more likely to jump between boats quickly, do a season here, do a season there?
Yeah, I guess that's probably fair. I mean, you know, when I started in the 90s, it was generally a year was a benchmark. And anything less than a year, you know, on each boat was a little bit flighty. Now we're into seasons, and you know, I have had circumstances where people are leaving mid-season, which is unheard of. You know, it was unheard of when I was a junior. You know, however bad things are on board, you'd always stick out the season. You know, with the hope of you know, showing yourself to be professional, whatever the circumstances, and you know, to get a reference at the end of the season. So, you know, I think. Obviously the internet and the availability of information and job boards and that sort of stuff has meant that you know, people do have the opportunity to look over their shoulder a bit more and jump ship. Most of the time the grass is not always greener. You know, a lot of people jump ship and then you catch up with them 6 months later and you go, oh, how did that work out? And you know, sometimes it's good, and a lot of the times it doesn't seem to be as good. You know, there's always a horror story. So, yeah, I don't see quite the patience, the willingness to dig in that we had. But you know, there's also a lot of, you know, condemnation of the younger generation, and I don't really buy that. I just think that they've got different values to us, and we have to work with them. Because we need the younger generation. You know, I'm not, I can't go out scrubbing decks anymore, and so I need those young guys and girls to do it for me.
Yeah. And what's your policy to rotation on Phoenix 2?
We've brought in quite a lot of rotation because it is what people expect, and to be honest, you have to be competitive in this market. A lot of the other yachts have it, you know, towards the junior ranks, and faced with a choice of same salary and a better leave package, they'll take the better leave package. So you always have to be competitive, and the whole market has moved, you know, from, let's say, in the 90s, it was, you know, a month's salary, a month's leave a year. Now it's, you know, crew are on 5 and 1 or 4 and 2 or whatever it is, variations of. And then in the senior ranks, my attitude is, you know, if you want people who are time served, you know, heads of department, 10 years, you know, chief engineers or captains, co-captains, you know, 20 years experience, which I believe, you know, a 90 meter, yacht deserves, then, you need to offer rotation, because somebody who's been, you know, working in the industry for 20 years and, you know, they want to have a home life as well, or some sort of shore life. And, you know, mm-hmm. people that don't are an exception. So, you know, some have families or some just don't want to spend 10 or 10 and a half months of the year on a yacht. It's too much once you've done it for 20 years. So,
yeah. And are you finding the expectation of rotation creeping down into more junior ranks on board?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think every year it moves down the level, it seems like. So yeah, we've, you know, it's come more common now for chief stewardesses, and now it's, you know, the requests are coming, you know, another level down. So yeah, currently my engineering team is on rotation, my deck officers are on rotation, and recently chief stews.
Well, it's, like you said, I think it seems to be a slight buyer's market on the crew side, because there are a lot, especially so many orders taken during the pandemic for yachts that are needing to crew up now that are coming out of sheds over the next few years. There is a massive crew demand. And so, you know, the expectation's inflated, isn't it? So if you're not prepared to offer rotation to a second stewardess, then that person will go elsewhere and find a different job.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, if you're running a charter boat, you need good, experienced crew. You know, you can't be taking on green crew who will accept, you know, the lowest packages, whether it's leave or money. You know, you need to be aiming for a really good standard of crew. And unfortunately, you have to offer competitive packages.
Well, let's look at your career, because I mean, you're someone who's been in the industry for a long time and has worked their way up to the most senior position on a very, very successful and big boat. So, you know, where did you start? Did you come from the commercial world or the military world, or was it always yachts for you?
It was actually always yachts. So I grew up in the Caribbean from a young age. So I was always, you know, and especially in my teenage years, diving, sailing, you know, out on the water a lot. So I had the kind of bit of a background. Then I was at university in England and finished university relatively young, and thought, I'll do a couple of years traveling before I settle down and get a shirt and tie job, you know, in the city or whatever. And yeah, so, and then I came across yachting, and it looked good. It looked fun. It, you know, tied in with my interest in diving and that sort of stuff, and, you know, allowed me to pay off student loans and whatever. So I thought, oh, I'll do this for a couple of years. And yeah, couple of years became a couple of decades. So yeah, I mean, I think with hindsight, in terms of my training and whatever, had I known at 20 that I was still going to be doing this at 47. I probably would have gone into the Merchant Navy and done their training, which is obviously more thorough. But you can't change the past. So yeah.
But to be a captain of a 90 meter at 47, that's no small achievement. That's running a significant boat like that. I mean, can you talk about some of your past commands and the jobs you took on your path to the captain?
Yeah, so I was actually 10 years as a chief officer, which I think is quite rare. And I think it really benefited me. A lot of people are a little bit more impatient and will take their first command, and let's say sometimes be a little bit inexperienced for it and get found out for it. But yeah, the 10 years was really, really beneficial for me. You see a lot of situations and you see it as the number two on board, and you watch how the captain reacts. And so that when you become captain, situations come up. It's not the first time you've seen it. You've seen it how it's been handled in another way, maybe better, maybe worse. So that I think really allows you to step into command with a lot more confidence, and for it to go a lot more smoothly. Yeah, like I say, I think some people are in a little bit too much of a hurry. It's a very big responsibility to run a yacht, both in terms of the actual equipment that you're running and the people on board that you're safeguarding. So.
Well, isn't that the magic of it, of a successful captain? The personnel management is, you're running a boat, obviously, but you're also running quite a large team of people and dealing with their issues and problems and what have you. That side of it is always the harder thing to learn, I think.
It is tricky, and I think obviously the old school doesn't work anymore. The only way that works is to try and empathize with people and understand what it is that they're saying or why it is they're asking or behaving in a certain way. You might not agree with it, but the basis is to understand people and understand that you're dealing with individuals. And from there, try and shape them to working on your yacht and making a cohesive team. On charter particularly, you really notice it doesn't work without all members of the team firing. From the laundryman to the deck crew to the service team, everybody's got to be on point. And I can't do those jobs myself. I need people. And we all need each other to do all of our jobs together. So, I think that's my sort of starting point for running the crew is we all need each other. We're all a team. We're all treated with respect. And then I make the decisions.
But I mean, like all captains, I'm sure you've got one or two horror stories about crew behaving badly that have been removed from the boat at the next port.
Yeah, none I'd particularly like to share, but when I think it's important that people know where they stand. They know the rules, they're clearly explained, they sign the master standing orders. When they overstep them, sometimes you can give a warning and whatever, or try and point out to people what you expect in the future. Sometimes it's just a blatant breaking of serious rules, and in which case, you have to act pretty swiftly and disembark those crew.
And you're managing down, but you're also managing up because there's lots of expectations from the owner and the charter broker's side. So that experience as well, surely longevity in the job means you learn tactics and strategies for relating to owners.
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic, with regards to owners, the most important thing is knowing what you're talking about. Speaking from experience and also from facts of, particulars of the yacht, of reasonable expenses or whatever. But all owners are different. Some are incredibly hands-on, both on the money side and also, the minutiae of the yacht and the crew. Some owners really want to, get involved because the yacht is their pet project. And some are very hands off and don't want to be bothered, burdened with the details. Happy to set a budget at the start of the year, and as long as you follow the budget, then great. And just want to step on board and have a great time on board. So, this is the full range, and I think you have to be prepared to operate under both of those kind of regimes.
Where's the sweet spot? Because I'm guessing no captain wants an owner constantly looking over their shoulder, scrutinising every penny that's being spent. But similarly, to have a completely laissez-faire owner of the vessel who doesn't take an interest in the running of the boat, not always great either. So where is that sweet spot?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I think, for a more hands-off owner, you always have to be prepared to justify your position. None of them became or remain wealthy by accident. So there's no, there's no fooling. And, so the idea of, if you spend some of their money, and particularly if it's a large, capital expenditure or upgrade or whatever, you have to be fully prepared to justify it in terms of you've researched that this is the best possible deal, that it was necessary, and have that evidence if required, because I think otherwise you'll get found out.
And I guess on that, I suppose, I mean, it's not a big industry, is it? And reputation matters, and word spreads very, very quickly through the various channels that we're all aware of. So if you do get a black mark against your name, it's, it makes your future existence much harder in the industry, doesn't it?
For sure. I mean, it is incredibly small. That's something that more junior people in the industry don't always appreciate. A lot of the time with new hires, I'll say, "Oh, just show me the CV," and I'll usually know one of those captains, mm-hmm. if not one or two, that they've got as references, and I'll just WhatsApp them or contact them on Messenger, and within 2 minutes I've got the lowdown, either good or bad. So and that happens a lot, so it is small once you've been around for a while.
Yeah, it really is. So let me ask as well your tips and strategies for dealing with your charter broker, because Edmiston has the charter CA for Phoenix 2, and I've spoken to captains and charter brokers, and sometimes it can be a slightly stressed relationship. I don't sense that with Phoenix 2. So, how do you make it work? What's the best way of dealing with the charter company looking after your boat?
I mean, Everston for the last 2.5 years have been great. We've built up a really solid relationship. I think it's always important for us to bear in mind that, charter brokers are trusting you with their biggest asset, which is their clients. If it's a bad charter, it reflects on them. They're the ones that are really gonna cop it, as well as obviously the captain. And so we have to respect that trust and build a confidence with them that that we'll take care of their guests and that they're gonna have the holiday of a lifetime. At the yacht shows, I like to have a lot of the charter brokers on board, and that's organised through Everston. We like to do dinners, have them on board to show, what our chefs can do, what our interior can do. A lot of the time we might be at anchor, so, they get a sense of the experience of, being brought out on the tenders and what have you. And just chatting, chatting with them individually, and that's actually been very successful. A lot of the charters that we've booked in the last couple of years have come from brokers that we've shown the yacht and entertained on board.
And how much repeat business does Phoenix 2 get? I'm guessing quite a lot, because she's such an idiosyncratic boat and such a special one.
For sure, yeah. And we, currently we have a very good client who is booked now for his third year on board. So yeah, we have a good amount of repeat business.
And long-term charters, that was a big thing during the pandemic, people taking boats for quite long periods of time. It seemed that seems to have retreated a bit. Is that your experience?
We had one six-week charter last summer, and it's the same client who's booked again for 6 weeks this summer. With that particular client, it's a dream. You know, they're incredibly easy to work with. They're incredibly grateful and kind and lovely people to have on board. You know, it is, if you have difficult clients, it would be a long 6 weeks. You know, and for all that we try, you know, we really have to work hard to stay within the hours of rest, you know, limitations. And, you know, one of the expectations I've found in the last couple of years that's come up is this idea of full 24-hour or 24/7 service, you know. So we have people ordering, you know, meals at 4 o'clock in the morning as if it was 8 p.m. And that's really hard to manage, and, you know, something that we're sort of looking into to manage some expectations, because we simply can't have our head chef working those kind of hours. It's, besides anything, illegal, but also, you know, it doesn't work in the long term. You know, you might be able to do it for 2 or 3 days. You certainly can't do it for more than a week, and over 6 weeks or whatever it is, over 3 weeks, it's just untenable. The quality goes down. You know, you still have to be mindful of the safety, and it's not fair either. So yeah, managing expectations a little bit, but you know, on a long charter, it's always nice to schedule in some time in port. You know, whether it's every, you know, once a week or whatever, because it realistically it does allow the crew to wind back and relax a tiny bit, to sleep better. To catch up on the provisioning and whatever. So that's always a kind of a plan. You know, a lot of guests might want to spend a lot of time at anchor, but it always is nice to get into port a little bit regularly to give a time to catch up.
The hours of rest thing is so important, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's a very hard thing to maintain on a very, very busy charter. Are you quite strict with it though? I mean, do you kind of send people to bed and say, that's it, go down below? And
we, I mean, of course, you know, yachts now for the last 10 or 15 years have been dealing with the hours of rest, and we all have, you know, rotas and plans for breaks and whatever. I'd say we're always on the limit. And, you know, I know myself, you know, the way I feel, you know, that I do have to get the right amount of rest sometimes, because, you know, sometimes I'm operating in some difficult situations on the bridge or whatever, and I have to be 100%. And it's not acceptable for me to not manage my time badly, which is the way I look at it, so that I'm not rested for when I need to be on form. Now, it's of course difficult, you know, if you're, because of the constant changing of shift patterns. You know, one day you might be having to pick up the anchor at midday, and then you have to also be picking up the anchor at 3 a.m. and what have you. And it's very difficult to tell the body to sleep when you need to, according to the plan for the next 24 hours. Sometimes it just doesn't work, but you have to try your best.
And do you, I mean, as a captain, it falls upon you to have those awkward conversations with guests sometimes who are making unreasonable expectations of the crew. I mean, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often. You try and, you know, you try and give people breaks in the background and rest as and when. But, you know, sometimes in exceptional circumstances, let's say we do a big party on board or something like that, then you do have to say, well, you know, the next day, the day after the big party, when everyone's been redlining, we do need to have a quiet day, and with, you know, very few extra guests on board, and catch up on our sleep. It's just for your safety, sir. You know.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, sounds like you don't have to have those conversations terribly often, which is good. I think those.
Yeah, try and avoid it, because of course, you know, the basis is not saying no. You know, that's the basis of our industry. And so rather than saying no, we try and work around it and come up with a solution, you know.
And how the Phoenix 2 kind of structure from Edmiston to you, to the owner, when new clients are applying for charter, I mean, how much diligence do you do on them?
Obviously, there's the, you know, all the financial diligence and what have you, which is done by our owner's office and by the brokers. And pretty much, you know, then the broker asks us, you know, gives us a rough outline of an itinerary and asks us what is possible and what's not. You know, usually it's a question of, okay, you finish your last charter in Dubrovnik on this date. When can you be in Naples on this date? And, to pick up this charter. Apart from that, you know, occasionally we have to make suggestions if we feel, you know, there's too much traveling, for example, or, you know, a lot of the passages are planned, you know, against the prevailing conditions. We might suggest, well, how about we do the charter the other way round so that we, you know, we're sailing, downwind predominantly, because you're just always trying to keep them as comfortable as possible. You know, there's I told you so doesn't really work, you know, when once you're in week two and you're bashing through bad seas or what have you. The fact that it was brought up in an email or a meeting 5 months before doesn't cut it. So, because you know that's our job is always to make the charter go smoothly and as seamlessly as possible and ideally with perfect weather, which is obviously out of our control.
And as a captain, when you do see those itineraries, do you how much is there often some eye rolling? Because obviously some captains have favorite places to take the boat, and you know they've got places they don't like taking the boat. Lots of captains will say we don't like Capri just because of the swell, and you know it can get a bit uncomfortable. I mean, so what are your favorite places? When you get an itinerary, you think just yes, that's going to be a great trip.
Recently we've really enjoyed Greece and Croatia. We've done parts of our charters in for both the last 2 summers there. You know, it is fair to say that some of the so-called milk run areas are getting a little bit too busy. You know, the anchorages are absolutely chock-a-block. In you know, when I started in yachting, I guess I was on smaller yachts, of course, but you know, generally 50 meters was a really deep anchoring spot, and you know, it was like, ooh, we're in 50 meters. Now, 50 meters is you know standard, and I've you know on the bigger yachts, you really have to stretch your comfort zone for how deep you end up anchoring, and obviously that means you're further out as well. So you know, 70 meters has become quite common. And you do see some yachts. I assume sometimes they're sitting on DP because you know they're sitting out there in 100 meters, and I don't understand how that works.
Do you have DP on Phoenix too?
No, not full DP. And ironically, one of the things we're doing in this refit is putting an extra shackle on our anchor chains to give us a little bit more scope. But then you have the limitation anyway. Our windlasses can only operate in about 80 meters of water. You can't pull up all that anchor and chain. So whatever happens, I'm not going any more than 75, obviously, to give myself a margin. But yeah, it is difficult in these really crowded anchorages that you kind of want to go to some of the less crowded ones because it's not that great an experience. You know, it feels a little bit like a parking lot. So,
And do you kind of steer the charter guest in the direction of the slightly less crowded anchorage?
I mean, it always, you know, sometimes they want to go to those places because they are those places, whether it's, you know, the Bay of Saint-Tropez and or whether it's Capri, as you say. And so you get on with it. But you know, it is nice to suggest the quieter places as an alternative. And I think they do appreciate that as well, you know, on a well-organized cruise. You know, there's a blend of everything.
What about St. Bart's at New Year's Eve? Have you done that in the boat?
Yep, it's a bit silly. I mean, I think it's actually becoming more and more of a thing, you know. You know, this year I was obviously looking at it on the AIS, and it's pretty hard work when the boats are all packed in like that, and you know, it does feel a bit like a parking lot. And of course, what it means is that there's an enormous number of beautiful bays, you know, in other spots around that are completely empty. So you know, it would be you know, really refreshing to get sent there sometimes as well.
Oh, we looked at the numbers recently, and there are 142 boats in the anchorage.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a bit silly, and you know, disregarding of the norms of reasonable anchoring, you know, especially on a yacht this size, you kind of have your comfort zone, your bubble around you that you like to have. You know, in that situation, you have to be willing to go down to, let's say, 1.2 cables or something around you, but then you'll get a captain who'll come in and anchor. You know, you can throw a chamois at them, you know. And you call them on the radio and you say, you know, excuse me, you know, I think you're a bit close. And they say, well, I don't think we're too close. And then you have a bit of an uncomfortable discussion and you remind them of their responsibilities. And you say, okay, you know, you might want to record the conversation or whatever, or take a photo. But ultimately, what it means is you have to be on the bridge monitoring this guy. You can virtually see him drinking his tea in his bridge.
He's staring right into his cabin, probably. Yeah,
and you know, if it goes on overnight, you don't sleep well because you've always got to be ready to jump up at a moment's notice if he's swinging your way or you're swinging his way. So I particularly dislike that. I always find it strange, you know, if anyone ever calls me up and questions, you know, how I've anchored, I'll always, you know, give it a think. And then if I'm in the wrong, then okay, yeah, you're right. I'll pick up and move a bit further away. No problem. But I've, in the last few years, I've experienced captains who have just refused and said, no, I'm here. I'm maintaining a bridge watch at all times. And then you sort of point out that, well, that's ironic because it took me 20 minutes to raise you on the radio and I had to send my tender over after I was flashing my searchlight at you to contact you. So how good is your bridge watch? But yeah, that's the reality of how we have to operate, unfortunately.
Into captain politics. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine what it'd be like running a boat, a big boat in the Gustavia anchorage in a violent wind shift at 3 a.m. in the morning. It must be quite a terrifying scene.
Yeah, not nice. My policy is always if you to have the bare minimum of things in the water, you know, down to ideally one tender, and if you think that something's going to happen in the night, down to zero tenders, because that's when things get really complicated, when it's not just about picking up the anchor, it's about getting other people up jump in tenders to tow them in the night, and that's where you're getting into, you know, quite dangerous situations and problems with lines in the water and whatever. So yeah, if there is a suspicion that the wind might change, everything out of the water.
Yeah safety first.
Yeah,
well, Ian, I can't thank you enough. I've really enjoyed spending the time with you, and yeah, best of luck with the next few months at MB92. And I hope to see you around the Med in the summer.
Okay. Thank you, Stuart. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Brilliant. Cheers, Ian. Speak soon. Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview. I hope you enjoyed it. This week's interview was mixed and produced by Adam Geist and Naomi Wilson and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe and tune in every week for our regular Boat Briefing podcast. See you next time.